I was in Antigua, Haiti. It was 85 degrees and sunny, just like every day there. It was dusty and it was fun. It was great, but it's really good to be back. But I will have to tell just two stories, or maybe just one, but during my class, I was teaching on ecclesiology, the study of the doctrine of church. It was interesting. We were talking about the issues of miracles and healing and the office of prophet and apostle and all those kinds of things. And they have a little bit different view of some of that, but I have to be honest with you. Their engagement on the issues of healing and of miracles is much higher than the way we kind of see things. And I said in a class, I said, you know, we probably in America kind of downplay those a little bit, probably too much. And you guys, I think, maybe kind of raise it above a little bit too much off of what it should be. And this one guy responded, and he said, that's because you have too many doctors in America. You don't need God. And I went, oh. I mean, it really cut me to the quick. And not that we don't value medicine and the incredible things that it's brought, and doctors. But obviously, it's not the perfect solution to everything, right? And they are saying, we don't have those things. And we are forced to trust the power of God in our lives. And it really shook me, to tell you the truth, and I really began to think, do I downplay the reality that there is a God who is powerful and real? And that he deals not just with our physical sickness, but with our spiritual sickness. And the reality that God is real. It really kind of rocked me, to tell you the truth. I took a little while to get my feet back underneath me, even during that class. And so as I come here this morning, I think probably we all come here not only to kind of relate and enjoy and whatever, but to discover the power of God in our lives, the reality of his presence, the kindness of his mercy, to see what it does in a human heart. And that is one of the great things I learned by being in Haiti, that people are faced with the spiritual battle every day in a powerful, powerful way. At night, you'll hear the drums going. And not all of them, but many of them are voodoo drums. And you hear it every night. And there is a clear spiritual battle that happens in that culture. We kind of downplay that. As a result, we kind of downplay who God is and make him much smaller than he actually is. So this morning, I hope that we really engage. Is God the power of who you are? How does it engage my life in the midst of this thing called the Family Circus, a sermon series on marriage and family, right? And just even after we started this series, we found out there actually has been a cartoon around for about 60 years called The Family Circus. And there's some really great ones on this. You look it up and he says, getting to eat all that cake might make it worth getting married. You know, like, yeah, totally. That's what a kid thinks. Or this one, they have to do that. It's their anniversary. Okay, I love this part. And there was another one I liked this week. It says this, if mommy hadn't married daddy, we'd be in some other family. I go, that's very logical and totally not true. You know, like, okay, we wouldn't exist. Okay, well, it's very interesting. This morning, setting the stage here, we want to focus this morning really on discovering and examining the biblical paradigms for marriage and family. What does the Bible have to teach us? And see that. We think it's important because in the scriptures, in Romans 12:2, it says, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may be discerned what is the will of God. What does God really have? And what his will is, that it's good. It's fundamentally good. And it's acceptable. It's embraceable. It's engageable. It's doable. We can put our arms around it. And in fact, not only that, but it's perfect. Absolutely perfect. God's will for us. Now, there's a conflict, right? Because sometimes we have a will too. And we battle between his will and our will. And sometimes it can get confusing. But we believe that that's his will are those things. And so here's the deal. The last couple of weeks, we've been talking about both the foundation and the substance of marriage. Okay, the foundation and the substance of marriage. And 2 weeks ago, we talked about really the foundation is a mutual submission to one another. In marriage, husband and wife, a mutual submission to each other. We're equals in this thing. We come to the table as equals in God's creation. And we come and he says, I want you to mutually submit to each other. Right? Of course. And then last week, we talked a little bit about the substance of that relationship. The fact that it is a love that is embedded with respect And it is a respect that is embedded with love. Remember at the end of that passage, he says, hey, husbands, love your wives. And it's not that she doesn't want to be respected. She does. But she wants to be loved. She wants to be the object of your affection, of your adoringness. And it embedded in that love is a respect. And women, it's what their deepest need is. It's a love that's embedded with respect. And for a guy, his deepest need is exactly the same, but totally opposite. His deepest need from his wife is to be respected, that is embedded with love. If you tell a guy, hey, I really love you, but I don't respect you, you might as well take his heart right out of his chest and put it on the ground with spikes on and just stomp on it. He needs to be respected, but it needs to be embedded with love, because he's not a feelingless guy. He has feelings too. He needs that love. And that's what we've been looking at the last few weeks, but and here's kind of what it looked like out of that passage in Ephesians. You know, to be careful how you live your life, to discover the heart and the will of God, you need to be filled with his Spirit. And as a result, over there on the right-hand side, it says, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. Out of a love for him, we submit to each other. And then if we blow that chart up a little bit, it's submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. And in this area called husbands and wives, there are two other areas, parents and children, employers and employees, where he applies this. We'll talk about parents and children in a few weeks. But today we're going to talk more and more about husbands and wives. And then a couple of weeks ago we showed you this chart. And you don't have to copy it down or anything. We'll have a copy for you at the end of the service. About the roles and responsibilities of the husband and the wife. About the deepest needs that we have that we need to relate to. And about the core response that each one of us has to the other one's role. These are critically important. And so here's the deal. When there are unfulfilled roles, when the husband doesn't live it out quite like he's supposed to, and when the wife doesn't live it out quite like she ought to, or unmet needs, you have particular needs, real, valid, reasonable needs, as a human being, as a woman, as a man, when they're not met, or when there's an inadequate response, when there's an inadequate response from your spouse. Guys, your response to your wife's role is to be praise. And when she doesn't feel praised, she doesn't feel appreciated, doesn't feel valued, it's hard for her. Gals, your response to his role is to respect. Doesn't mean to agree with everything. Doesn't mean that you think he's, you know, perfect. Clearly he's not perfect. But to respect, to honor him as a human being and the role that he's trying to play. Those are your deepest needs. When those are not met, what's the result? What's it equal? Well, it equals conflict. That's what happens. When our roles are messed up, when our needs aren't met, when our responses are inadequate, there's conflict that happens. I don't know, maybe you don't have conflict in your home or in your marriage or in your family or at work. Maybe you don't have it. I've experienced it a couple of times over the 36 years of marriage. We've had a couple of marital adjustment opportunities, like maybe a lot of them. And we've had conflict in our marriage, and it happens, right? So here's the deal. I have a series of so comments here. So resolving conflict has become a challenge in every human being and in every relationship, and especially in this thing called marriage, right? Of course, solving conflict is something we do every day, every week, every month, every year, every decade. So here's another thought. So here's just a brilliant thought. The best way to deal with conflict is to not have it. Is that like brilliant or what? I said this in staff meeting a few months ago. I'm like, here's what I want to speak on. The best way to not have conflict, to deal with conflict, is to not have it. I like that thought, right? And here's a secondary thought. To not have conflict, you either have to be perfectly mature or you have to fake it. Right? Isn't that the way you do it? You either be perfectly mature and so you don't have conflict, or let's just fake it, because that's maybe the best way we can go about, because none of us have become perfectly mature yet, except for Christ. That's why him living inside of us helps us to grow, helps us to do this. But either that or we have to fake it. So, next statement, so statement. So, what's the solution? What's the solution? I wonder if Philippians 1, verses 9 and 11. Let me just read this. This is Paul as he prays for them. I wonder if it might be a prayer that we pray for ourselves and for each other. So this is my prayer, that your love will flourish and that you will not only love much, but that you will love well. Learn to love appropriately. You need to use your head and test your feelings so that your love is sincere and intelligent, not sentimental gush. Live a lover's life, circumspect and exemplary, a life that Jesus will be proud of, bountiful in fruits from the soul, making Jesus Christ attractive to all, getting everyone involved in the glory and the praise of God. The way we live our lives would be a life of love, right? And it seems so simple. Jesus said it from the very beginning. What's the key thing in all of life is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, to love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets is all wrapped up in that. That's as big and as complicated as it needs to get. Period. Let's go home. Right? Well, I have another so statement. So, what unhealthy and inadequate substitutes for real love did you learn growing up? Now, isn't that, I mean, if you said, I want to learn how to love, I want to love. I mean, it's just kind of a core thing to all of us. But there might be some problems along the way. Maybe what you learned wasn't so great. Maybe what you thought was love actually isn't love, or at least as much as it should be. In a really great book called How We Love by Mylan and Kay Yerkovich, this is an incredible book. Di and I, it's really helped us personally. In this book, he kind of identifies four unhealthy and inadequate styles of what we think was love, but actually wasn't. The first one he talks about is being a pleaser. You know, it seems like being a pleaser is a good idea. Please people, do what's pleasing to them. But, you know, really be a nice guy, be a pleaser, right? This is what I learned growing up. My dad was kind of a pleaser, and he taught us very clearly, almost verbatim, hey, here's the deal to keep mom off the warpath is to be a pleaser. Just please her. Yeah, shut up, stop arguing. Just please her, will you? And I learned that. So I pleased my mom, I pleased my dad, I pleased my brothers and sisters, I pleased my teachers. The only way I made it through high school Spanish was being a pleaser. I didn't learn much Spanish, but I was really a nice guy. And I pleased, and I got a pretty good grade. I didn't get an A. That would have been inappropriate. But I got a B. Though I probably did D work, but I got a B because I was a pleaser. And that's the way you learn to deal with life until you can't please enough people enough times for as long as you should. And then when you can't, but you worked really hard at it, then you become resentful. And resentfulness can't be really the result of love, can it? But I thought it was. Or a pleaser, or you can be an avoider. That looks like a nice way to love, right? Let's just avoid the problem. You know, here's a conflict, here's an issue. Well, let's just avoid it because that doesn't sound like much fun doing it. So I'm just going to kind of try to walk around it, right? And we'll just walk around it and act like it didn't happen and we'll just keep going. Be an avoider. That seems like a loving thing to do. Why enter into a conflict? It's going to be hard. It might hurt people's feelings. Let's just avoid things, okay? Especially if you, and then you get to be a pleaser, and you get to marry an avoider. And then all of a sudden, I'm trying to please her, and she's trying to avoid me. And I'm trying to pursue her, because I'm trying to please her. And every time I move a little faster to try to please her, she's trying to avoid, because she knows there's a conflict, and I'm trying to solve it by simply being a pleaser, not by actually loving. And so, in our first year of marriage, you had a pleaser and you had an avoider who were totally not figuring it out. Later, we looked back and she said, in that first year of marriage, she thought she had made the biggest mistake of her whole life. That was humbling to hear. And I actually was thinking, this is either going to be a really short marriage or this is going to be a really long life, you know? And because we weren't dealing with conflict very well. Because I was a pleaser, she's an avoider. Or maybe you're a vacillator. This is one of those places where people, they draw in close when it's safe. But as soon as it's not very safe, they pull away. And they stay away for a day or a week or a month or a year. They just vacillate in and out, depending on how safe it is. Or you become a controller slash victim. A controller kind of says, hey, what I grew up with, I didn't like. And I'm not going to do that anymore. But instead of really learning to love, they learn to control. And they control everything in their lives and in the lives of other people. And they work really hard at it. Not because they want to be just mean and ugly. They don't. They want to just say, what I experienced isn't good. And I want this to be better. So I'm going to control my wife. I'm going to control my kids. I'm going to control my work. I'm going to control everything I do. And when it doesn't work, because eventually you can't control everybody, right? If some people don't cooperate, as foolish as that might be, they don't cooperate. And then you become the victim. And you go, oh, poor is me. I worked so hard at doing this. And now you didn't cooperate. And man, I'm the victim here. And they whine about it. And it's a great way to control people, right? To be the victim. Because then they go, oh, I don't want you to feel bad. I know, okay, let's do it your way. They go, yeah, right, good. You know, isn't that what we do? These inadequate ways of dealing with love? Well, another so comment. So, since we all have conflict in our relationships, how can we resolve them in a more mature fashion rather than the habitual repeating the broken dance? That's why we showed the video. You saw that. Didn't that look like fun? Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers. I mean, they were like good. They're good at it, right? I mean, they're all over the place. They're tap dancing, swing dancing, jumping over the little railings. I mean, isn't that what our marriages ought to look like? You know, this beautiful situation. They're just like so in step with each other. That's what we bought into, right? And then when all of a sudden in a dance, we're stepping on each other's toes, we run into each other. Eventually you say, hey, let's not do the dance anymore. Let's just see if we can do, you know, kind of more modern dance where we never have to touch each other. And see if we can figure that out. Well, this habitual repeating of the broken dance that we do with each other that unfortunately does this, it damages and it destroys our relationships. And not just our marriages, our families, the place where we work, our neighborhoods. We learn. And so I've said it to Diane. I'm working at it. I am not committed to pleasing you anymore. That feels so horrible to me. It's like, wow, that's a mean thing to say. Why can't you ever say that? But I have to follow it up by saying, I am really trying to learn not to please you anymore, but to love you. You guys, this has been a lifelong, we're not done yet, 36 years into it, we're still figuring it out. But to love, not to please or avoid or vacillate or control, but to love. Wow. Well, here, you guys, I'm going to just walk through a chart with you today. And you don't have to take a picture of it because I'll have a copy of it on your way out for you, okay? I'm going to walk you through a chart that I think may help you. It's a very biblical chart, I think, of how to deal with conflict. And so we're going to conflict resolution, right? We're going to put that at the top. And in the middle, I want to add a circle here. I want to add a circle that's called growth and maturity. Isn't that what he's really called us to, is growth and maturity? Look at Colossians chapter 1, verse 28 and 29. It says, we proclaim him, this is Paul, we proclaim Christ, warning everyone and teaching everyone with all wisdom that we may present everyone mature in Christ, growing, more mature all the time. And look at this, I love this. For this I toil, struggling, with all his energy, with all the energy that Christ gives us, that he powerfully works within me, that we would work hard at maturity. That's what he's doing here. He's fighting for their maturity. So, growth and maturity is in the middle. So let's start up at conflict, okay? Let's go to the top. We've got conflict going in the red box here. Maybe you have conflict. I've talked with some friends in the last few days that said I needed this chart before today because yesterday we had conflict, and this would have been helpful. But, you know, when you have conflict, sometimes you get hurt feelings. When someone doesn't meet your needs, someone doesn't seem to care for your needs, or they don't really respond very well to your role, or maybe they don't do their responsibilities or whatever it is in the marriage, and there's hurt feelings. And sometimes that can even translate into anger. that can jump right down to this place where we get angry about it. Now, not all anger is wrong, but often the way we deal with anger seems to be not very productive. Look at this in James chapter 1. It says, "My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry." Why? Because this. Because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. Have you ever seen that in your relationship? Where your response to a hurt feeling was anger that really didn't help. It damaged and destroyed what you really wanted. It can happen so easily. There are four primary feelings, I think, that even come before anger. It's one of the books that I've been wrestling with for probably 20 years called Dealing with Anger, Turning Life's Most Troublesome Emotion into an Asset in Life, Facing the Anger in Our Lives. That anger really is a secondary emotion. There's a primary emotion that comes before that. And that emotion usually has something to do with one of these four things, that we feel powerless. We hate feeling powerless, right? We resent it. We don't want to be humiliated and say, hey, well, I'm not powerful enough. Or we feel dependent. We hate feeling dependent on other people. I want to be independent. I want to be self-sufficient. We feel dependent and we hate that. And that feels demeaning. It feels humiliating. Or we feel unimportant. This is probably the one I've struggled with the most in life. Is feeling unimportant when people either say or do things that make me feel that way. I say, you made me feel angry. No, anger was my decision as a response to what felt humiliating, and I get angry. Or we feel exposed. We feel uninvitedly revealed to people, and our weaknesses are shown. We hate that. And as a result, we choose to be angry about it. But when we're angry, it seems to me we really have two choices, right? Let's go in the next box. There's two choices we can make. The first one is this, is to flee, is to withdraw, to let the problem fester, to run away. And some of you might say, oh, yeah, good, that's what I do. I run away. I flee. I don't want it. I fester. But the problem is, look at the bottom, it escalates isolation. Remember back in Genesis, it said that it was not good for man to be alone, and so he made a suitable helper for him, and Ezra, a warrior to stand with him, and to be together, to have unity and community, to be connected. But when we flee, we escalate isolation from each other. In a marriage, that can get really, really hard. The loneliest place in the world is not being in bed alone, it is being in bed back to back. That is the loneliest place. And to flee and to separate isolates each other. And it's really destructive. Or the other choice is this, is to choose to face the conflict. Now, I don't know about you, but I think that's one of the hardest things in all of the human experience, is to look at a conflict, you see it, you're involved in it, it's happening, it's right in front of you, and you say, I'm going to engage it. You just think, because there's somewhere else I could go. Could I run away? Could I avoid this? Could I be a pleaser? Could I vacillate? Could I control it? Whatever it might be, is we say, I'm going to flee. Or are we going to say, we're going to face the conflict? Wow. Now, if you face the conflict, let's go here. If you face the conflict, there are two choices now to be made too, right? If you're going to say, I'm going to face the conflict, one of the things that you could decide to do if you face it, is you're right, I'm going to take it on, and I am going to fight. Because I am going to win. I'm going to demand, I'm going to put you down, I'm going to denigrate you, I'm going to win over you, and all that does is escalate the conflict, right? Of course. You say, I'm going to engage this, and you're going to wish I didn't. Look at Galatians 5:15, it says, but if you bite and devour one another, watch out that you are not consumed by one another. We can do that in our relationships. We can begin to put down, devalue, degrade, judge, attack. And what we do is we damage and we destroy our relationships. if we choose to fight. It's the same kind of damage and destructions that we do when we flee. It's just more painful and woundful. It creates deep set bitterness and resentment towards each other. So if you're not going to choose to fight, if you choose to face the conflict and not going to choose to fight, what are you going to do? Here's what you have to do. You have to invite each other to dialogue. What it sounds like this, it's pretty simple. Hey, let's talk. We need to talk. Can we talk about this? I felt hurt. I was kind of angry about it. I really want to run away, but I don't want to run away, so I'm choosing to face the conflict. I don't really want to fight about it, but it feels fearful for me, but I'd like to talk. Can we talk? Can we sit down and talk? Can we put it on the table? Can we deal with it? Now, you guys, most of our probably skills and abilities growing up didn't get to this place. We dealt with it in so many different ways. But to say, okay, can we do this? Can you see? This is a new dance. This is a whole new dance step to be able to walk through this. And so we come to a place where it's an invitation to dialogue. He says, let's talk. Look at this in Ephesians chapter 4. It says, speaking the truth in love. Now he's talking about all sorts of conflicts here. He's talking about even a conflict in the church. And just look at this. This whole thing could be lived out in a church too, right? Will people run away, refuse to deal with the conflict? What happens? It increases isolation. It's not just like, well, I'll just go someplace else. You think it goes away? It doesn't go away. It just gets worse. It's just a lingering wound inside of a church. It's a lingering wound inside a family if we don't deal with things. It's a lingering wound inside a marriage if we don't deal with things. And so he says we have to come to this place of speaking the truth. In fact, the real translation here would be truthing in love. But speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love. It grows. Your marriage will grow if you truth in love. Tell the truth, but do it lovingly. Be loving, but you have to tell the truth. In fact, there's a really great quote here out of the book Meaning of Marriage by Timothy Keller. He writes this, "The gospel is this. We are more sinful and flawed in ourselves than we ever dared believe. Yet at the very same time, we are more loved and accepted in Jesus Christ than we ever dared hope. This is the only kind of relationship that will really transform us. Love without truth is sentimentality. It supports and affirms us, but keeps us in denial about our flaws. Truth without love is harshness. It gives us information, but in such a way that we cannot really hear it. God's saving love in Christ, however, is marked by both. And if that's what he is marked, his love is marked by, so ought ours to be marked by truthing in love, telling the truth, and being gracious all at the same time." So, if you're going to invite to dialogue, and say, let's talk, then the goal has got to be this. It has got to be to understand and to forgive and to compromise. To understand, not with the goal of being understood, but with the goal of understanding the other person. You might say, man, you think so differently than I do. And therefore, we discount them. We cast them out. You think differently than me, clearly I'm right, you're wrong, you're gone. See ya. Or what if we entered into the relationship and say, I want to understand you. Guys, one of the clearest passages in the scripture out of 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7, it says, likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, not spiritually or emotionally, weaker in the sense of physically, because we can so easily try to overpower with our physical and our anger. He says, don't do it. Knock it off. But since they are heirs with you in the grace of life, mutually submissive, right? Co-heirs with Christ. No different. So that our prayers may not be hindered. Here's the deal. You don't live your life in an understanding way, God is not going to listen as well in your life because you've refused to love her and understand her. Whoa. I just read a quote yesterday. This guy said, if you really want to be happy in life, be single. Because there's less conflict, at least in that face-to-face marriage one. But you got to understand one another. Gals, you need to understand your wives, your husbands too. You need to understand. Reach in and try to understand. It's the first thing. And not only that, let's circle it, but you need to forgive. This is so important that next week, this is all we're going to talk about, is how to forgive, how to enter into a forgiveness with each other. Because we wrong each other, we hurt each other, and we can hold on to that. Do you have one of those lists? You know, a list of just to keep track of everything they ever did? And then 15 years later, you can say, remember when you did this? You go, am I never going to live that down? Am I never going to have it let go? Well, yeah, I'll let it go. And then the next time you get into conflict, remember when you did this 20 years ago? Boom, 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 boom. And we can just list it out. Remember all you knucklehead, you know? You just hold on to all that stuff. How do you really forgive? In Sacred Marriage, it's a book by Gary Thomas. He says this, one of marriage's primary purposes is to teach us how to forgive. I say it in every wedding service I do. There are two things that we do to reflect what God is like. The first one is the ability to forgive. The second is that we keep our promises. That's what God is like. God forgives. We're going to have to forgive. So we'll talk about that whole thing next week. And here's the deal. If we get into this dialogue and we understand, we forgive, and we compromise, it doesn't lead to conflict. It doesn't. It leads to growth. It leads to maturity. Because we've engaged each other, we've heard each other, we understand each other, we appreciate each other, we can forgive each other, we can compromise, we can make this work. We can be a warrior and a warriorette together. Right? We can do this as a team. Because God created mankind in his image, male and female. He created them to be together. And to do it well and to honor one another and love one another, build up one another, to recognize the great teamness of it, will grow. St. Francis de Sales, he was the bishop of Geneva, once said this, the state of marriage is one that requires more virtue and constancy than any other. It is a perpetual exercise of mortification. You think, whoa. Mortification sounds like a mortuary. Well, here's the deal. To be the mortification of the flesh. It is to die to self and live to him. It is to die to our own selfishness and to give ourselves to those relationships that God has put in our lives that we need to give our lives to. It is a perpetual exercise of dying to self and loving deeply rather than being a pleaser or an avoider or a vacillator, or a controller, it means to love. And this state of marriage is one that requires more virtue and constancy than any other relationship. Wow. That's incredible. And here's what I think it unfolds to. It unfolds to hope. When you can solve conflict in your relationships, don't you feel so much more hopeful? That this isn't going to be either a really short marriage or a really long life. You know, we'll make it through. Yeah, we'll probably have times where it's difficult. We're going to make it through. Because we've committed ourselves to work it out, no matter what. And let's stop fleeing, and let's stop fighting, but let's engage one another. Let's put it on the table. And let's find understanding and forgiveness and compromise to make it better. So where do we go from here? Here's just a few thoughts. I'll put them all up there at once. Having the commitment and the skills to resolve conflict is a profoundly important dimension of every relationship. Right? Of course, in your marriage, in your family, at work, in your neighborhood, in your extended family, working out conflict is absolutely critical to its success. As I do premarital counseling, it's clear to me that there are three things that are going to kill a marriage. If they cannot figure out their finances, if they can't figure out communication and conflict resolution, and if they can't figure out how to be intimate, both spiritually and physically and emotionally, there's not much hope for a very healthy marriage. And so it is important that they learn how to resolve conflict. Secondly, there are two unhealthy tendencies that we often and even habitually choose to escalate and isolate escalate either the isolation or the tension. It's to run away and flee, or it is to fight. Which one of you? Let me just ask the question. You don't have to raise your hand. You can do it when you go home. Which one do you tend to be? Do you run away from conflict? Flee it? Avoid it? Try to be a pleaser? Like me? Try to please, 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 please? It was really not dealing with it? What do you tend to do? Because if you're fleeing, you're just simply escalating your isolation. Or do you tend to be a fighter? You know, the biblical word is pugnacious. Tend to be a fighter. Guess what? Even the pleaser can be a fighter, because when he gets resentful, he comes over here to fight. Because then I'm not happy. Right? The avoider, not so much a fighter. The vacillator, not so much a fighter. The controller, clearly a fighter. The victim, clearly a fighter, just in a cheap, kind of backwards way. What do you do? What's your brokenness? What's your broken style? Last but not least, are you willing to work on developing a better dance, a more productive dance in your marriage? And here's the deal. I just so wish that God could take some pixie dust and just kind of sprinkle it over us. I mean, really, if I could like install it here in the building, I would just say, great, let's do it. Let's just kind of, you know, have it come down on everybody. And as a result, we'd walk out of here and you'd be perfect at resolving conflict. Your families would be cool. I mean, it'd be smooth sailing. All your kids would obey. They would do exactly what you think. They'd be fulfilled and happy. Your marriage would be incredible. That's really what I want God to do in my life. Actually, that's what I want him to do. But he says, well, Kevin, here's the deal. I'm going to put you through a different system to get there. Because Romans 5, it says that in suffering produces endurance. And endurance, guess what it produces? Character. And guess what character produces? Hope. And I'm going to put you through the ringer, Kevin. I'm going to grow you. That's how I'm going to do this. And I have the power to do it, Kevin. I am powerful in your life. I can help you grow, become more mature, to deal with conflict. Your marriage can be better than it was yesterday because you deal with these things. I want to grow you. I want to put you through a process. So the question is, are you willing to let God do that in your life and develop a better dance so that at least some days you could feel like Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire? You go, man, we're doing pretty well. That was fun. That was cool. Now the next day you might have a conflict. Okay, you work it out. But the more you work at it, the better the dance gets, right? But the reality is we really need to turn to him and say, God, I submit myself to you. I'm not going to be the king in my own life. I'm not even going to be the king in my own marriage. It's your will be done on earth and in my marriage as it is in heaven. You have your way. You have your way with me. And I'm going to commit myself to this human being that you put me in a marriage with. I'm going to see her as God's provision. I'm going to see him as God's provision. And we're going to learn to dance better. So where are you at today? Are you willing to let him do the hard work? Are you willing to do the hard work? Am I willing to do the hard work? So you guys, would you just take a moment and ask the Lord to speak to your own heart and maybe bring to mind the things that you need to do in order to resolve conflict that can be so painful in our lives. And you might say, well, it's too late. It's too late. We developed this dance over a lot of years. Can't do it. He can't do it. And I'm here to tell you, he can. It might be hard. It might be hard, but he can do it. It's just like my friends in Haiti said, you have too many other answers. You don't need God. But in this one, we do. This one, we do. So would you take a moment? Identify yourself as a fleer or a fighter. What do you need to come to the table in order to understand, forgive, find compromise, to grow? So take a minute before we close.